Hello, this is Cameron McCune and Bob Dobbs with episode number 66 of our ongoing analysis of my book. And we're still thinking about the idea of pre-tribal awareness, which we might claim is a new discovery in McLuhan studies, something that's never been talked about. And more than me, Cameron is looking into things and finding other quotes. And so what he found was Wittgenstein. It says Zettel number 445 is some kind of an encyclopedia of thoughts by him.
Yes, Zettel is a box or a drawer. So all of Wittgenstein's work after, or I shouldn't say all, but 95% of his work after around 1930 was never published. And editors after his death started to put together editions of his writings. And one of the editions of his posthumous notes is called Zettel.
What does that mean?
Or, it means a shoebox or a drawer.
Okay.
It's just a collection of notes.
Which is what I found in McLuhan's archives, 60 boxes of miscellaneous articles and clippings thrown in each box.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And where is that? Is that in
Well, my job was to put them in order, keep it, whatever was in each box. No, not keep in order. So look at every box and then sort of work out a linear sequence. So find articles that I figured would be the 40s, put them in the earlier boxes. So I remade the boxes in sequential order of the articles and stuff. I put the boxes into order. You see what I mean?
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And apparently I'd be one of the few people to do it because I knew his corpus. I knew the whole work, so I could figure out which decade something was in, you know. So that's what I did. And that's without the bibliography.
That's still in the early 1980s, right?
Yeah, that's December 1981, before anything.
Yeah.
Other than the inventory that Marg Stewart made. But so I organized that, a few other miscellaneous stuff. Then they got someone else to do the letters, I think, or the letters were already done. I'm not sure. But there were a lot of letters, so I think the letters hadn't been done yet. So then I left and other people took over, and then they sold it about 1984 in Ottawa. And then it had to be organized for a couple of years, and Philip Marchand organized it, got the job there. I don't know how he figured that out or what he knew or was he already at the archives, but he took advantage of going through and inventorying the archives to write his book, to take notes.
Yeah,
that's where his book came from. And the book came out in 89. So then it took us a couple of years to have access to what they organized, right? It maybe by 89, 90 it was ready. I started getting stuff, I think, by 1990. So that's almost 10 years later. So I operated just from understanding what he wrote in different decades. You know.
Yep.
So then that was an orderly thing for them, and so that's how they helped them sell the archives, by putting that into order. Everything else was in pretty good order. You know what I mean? Just the boxes were all messed up. So let's see. So that's Wittgenstein's box. And he says, I looked up Wittgenstein. Was he married? I couldn't really find out anything on the Wikipedia.
No, he wasn't married.
Was he gay?
Well, there's a difference of opinion about that. But
I did read about the guy, David somebody, he hung out with for a while, you know.
Right.
Yeah, yep. So they don't know about that. Why didn't he publish after 1930?
Because he was in the academy trying to think against the academy.
Yeah.
And he tried over and over again to order his thought but he was never able to do it. And I think he came to believe that not being able to order was actually what philosophy was about, mm-hmm. or at least an important part of what philosophy was about, that any order would distort what needed to be done.
Yeah.
So I think eventually he thought, well, my job is mostly to do notes and to try to get younger colleagues actually to think. And between the two of those callings, that's sort of what my job is as a philosopher.
Yeah, the two being get some colleague, and what's the first one?
Making the notes.
Making the notes. And yeah. So putting them in order wasn't a priority.
Well, I mean, he kept trying to do it, but he never succeeded. And I think he came to feel that not being able to do it was actually an important part of what he was up to.
And that way so he was going post-book. It wasn't important to put it into a book form.
Correct. But also look at the quotation that we have here.
Yeah.
The philosopher is not a citizen of any thought community. And by the way, thought community there can be translated as tribe.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? The philosopher is not a citizen of any tribe. So that means that the philosopher exercises pre-tribal awareness.
Yeah. And then he says, the philosopher is not a citizen of any thought community. This is what makes him into a philosopher. And if you understand
right.
philosopher as some kind of detachment about the community, about its involvements and engagements and habits and screw-ups, the philosopher
right.
does not want to get trapped in that somehow.
Right. And but notice the phrase, any thought community. So it's not a question of being detached from one community. It's being detached from all possible communities.
Yeah, and that might be Platonic, looking at saying thought is the underpinning of all communities, whereas Aristotle, if you say he looks into the senses, he looks into the cultures, he starts seeing differences in tribes and gets lost in that, if you consider the Platonic method purer. Not necessarily, but do you see what I mean?
Well, I think I see what you mean, but I don't think I agree with it. Because when the philosopher is not a citizen of any thought community, that's what makes him into a philosopher. I think what he's talking about there is creativity, the creativity that is before any action or any understanding within a tribe. So McLuhan would certainly agree with that. For McLuhan, every moment of perception involves creativity, involves art. So what McLuhan would try to do and what Wittgenstein was trying to do was question how we can understand this creativity that is before all human action.
Yeah, before all human action, which would create society and culture or tribe.
Yeah.
So it just sounds a little pure to talk about thoughts, but maybe that is the form of cognition before tribal memes, tribal ideas, tribal rigidities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So notice one of the things that does, thinking of it, creativity in this way, as something that is always exercised in every moment of human being, no matter how primitive, no matter how sophisticated, is that makes creativity into a perennial activity, into a simultaneous or all at once activity, not a linear one.
Yeah.
So you often express yourself, I would say,
yeah.
in terms of linear examples, because
when I'm using a linear medium.
That's right. You're trying to communicate in a certain way, number one. And number two, what you're talking about That is to say, human activity is linear, right? It's in, there is no such thing as human beings standing, you know, outside of time and outside of their community and all that sort of stuff. It's just that in order to be a part of a community, to be a part of language, to be a human being that's experiencing things, you need to be creative. And that creativity is somehow aside from the very thing that it enables. So it's difficult to talk about.
Yeah, now, you said all communities are linear? You didn't say that, but what are you saying about linearity? So I'm presenting things linear. Thought is linear, or?
Well, I mean, I'm saying that thought is both linear and all at once.
Right.
Or in McLuhan's early terminology, thought is linear and ancient. So you have the ancient quarrel that is always expressed in what's going on linearly. Right? And that's, he tries to describe that in his Nash thesis, and in the ancient quarrel in modern America. And the importance of that for McLuhan can be seen in the fact that he makes that the last essay in The Interior Landscape,
yeah,
which is, what, 25 years later?
Yeah, so, 1969, right. Well,
yeah.
It was written in 40, that one was written 46, but it goes up to 42.
It's, yeah, it was...
No, 62, collection of stuff up to 62.
Yeah, that's the part of, from 62 is the chapter Out of Gutenberg Galaxy.
Yeah, so
everything else is prior to that. Everything else, before the part of Gutenberg Galaxy that's in there, the latest is the Coleridge essay,
yeah,
which was, I think, 57.
Yeah, yeah.
But
so,
this, the thing that worked, the ancient quarrel was actually a lecture in St. Louis in 1944, and it just wasn't published until 46. But it was written almost at the same time as the thesis, and it was a way of bringing the thesis up to date.
Yeah, and then it didn't get any more coverage for 25 years, till 69.
Correct, yeah.
Okay, so the idea of the perennial wisdom, which people attach to mystics or gurus and things, I think that McLuhan says this is not good enough, just the perennial wisdom, that to just think of thought and being detached, which is usually a visual bias, is not enough. So he had
Correct.
To get into the dirt and not do what Wittgenstein's doing. He wouldn't say it was a thought community. You know, he would say nonverbal gesture or ESP, mental dance. But he had to get into the Aristotelian to get you somehow not limited if you were following Wittgenstein and going with the thought community. Because a lot of people think that being detached is just thinking out of the box. But it's thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It's lost in thought, and usually it's limited by their cultural assumptions.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But remember that there is no such thing as being assumption-less.
Yeah.
Right. The great mystery is that human beings cannot get away from the rearview mirror, but that does not mean that they can't be creative. And so the whole problem is to think together the rearview mirror and creativity. And that problem is a problem that's goes back as far back as human beings go.
Yeah.
So. When we're talking about, say, McLuhan and Wittgenstein, I don't think we should say that McLuhan is doing something that Wittgenstein didn't see. I would say that both of them are trying to grapple with a very old problem, namely, how are we going to express and turn to public use the notion that human beings are both creative and tribal.
Yeah, so he says the philosopher is not a citizen of any thought community. So the cliche response to uneducated people, unsophisticated people, is the philosophers think. All right? So they would find this odd. What? He doesn't engage in thought? And then it says, this is what makes him a philosopher. So, yeah, that's a good statement. So it just occurred to me while you were talking there that McLuhan would agree with that, but he recognized there were new cultural problems created by Finnegan's Wake and modernism that needed to be gone into to sort out to get back to the thought community. And Wittgenstein didn't know that stuff, apparently. So he got bogged down and isolated. He couldn't put on the culture anymore. Whereas McLuhan took new stuff that he could put on and with the same goal as Wittgenstein, but you can see he had something to talk about. And he makes fun of Wittgenstein in Explorations, one of the maybe number eight, and he says, you know, Wittgenstein was afraid to leap into the abyss. Remember that part?
Yeah, but I don't, you know, McLuhan often threw out stuff that, you know, he didn't know much about, and he was just, it was like throwing pasta at the wall to see if it would stick.
No, I liked McLuhan. He knew that, you know, I cannot speak of what I cannot say or something, whatever that famous line is, you know. McLuhan says, you ain't talking. I'm not, you're not stopping me talking. You know, I'll speak of what I can't say.
Yeah, exactly. He was like his father in that respect. He spent his whole life talking about stuff that he didn't know what he was talking about.
Okay, let me ask you this before I forget. I just read today, Alan Watts, you know who he is?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, he makes a claim somewhere, someone sent it to me, that the phrase rearview mirror or rearview action, anyways, rearview, McLuhan got from him. Does that sound possible?
Yeah, it sounds possible. But I would think that it probably in cybernetics that came up a lot. Watts was already active in the 40s and maybe even in the end of the 30s. I'm not quite sure about his years of activity. But I think that notion was kind of in the air.
Okay, because you don't recall when he first uses it. Is it the mid-60s when he starts saying it, McLuhan?
Yeah, I don't really recall, but, I mean, certainly in the mid-60s he is.
Yeah.
So it would be a question of wondering if he had talked about it before.
Yeah, used it once
and
or twice.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't think so. It doesn't sound familiar that he used it way back there. But I know that in Cultures Are Business, I know that Alan Watts visited him. Says that he visited McLuhan. That would be 66, 67, the way I time it, because McLuhan's gone to New York in 67, 68. So,
But wasn't Watts in San Francisco? He might have hooked up with him in one of McLuhan's San Francisco trips.
No, he said he visited him and went to Toronto. Went to his home, if I read that right. That might be true what you're saying, but in my memory, you visualize that when you read it. You say, he went into the house there, you know. My mind visualized it. So I have that visualization. He's in the house. So he must have said that, I would think. Anyways,
McLuhan didn't live in Winchwood in the 60s.
That's right.
Did he?
No, he moved in Winchwood in 68. And this would be 66, 67. So, and then Watts is distracted from 67 on. He becomes a big McLuhan-type figure himself, doing videos and leading the Ginsberg Revolution there with Tim Leary and all that, you know, after the human loving and all those things. But so then in 1970, McLuhan takes a pot shot. He says Watts, he refers to Watts, and he says he's too simple, meaning Gutenbergian. He's too simple. Mm-hmm. And do you remember that being said?
No, but...
Yeah, it's in there. One little sentence in passing. So... Mm-hmm. Watts, he should have said, I turned McLuhan on a rearview mirror. And then later, I read a book and he said I was simple. But I bet he never even knew it. He didn't read Cultures Are Business. And he died in 73. He was a bit of an alcoholic, people say, in that era. That's the guy who sent it to me said, this is probably bullshit. Watts was an alcoholic. So, anyways, that's a side thing. So back to, so we've talked about Wittgenstein's statement, not a citizen of any thought community. This is what makes him into a philosopher. Now, many philosophers knew this, people are called philosophers in the canon, but they may not have said it this way. What do you think?
No, I think you're right. My take on all of this is always that what is at stake is not something new. What is at stake is the communication of something new.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you seem to be saying that lots of people have thought this, and I think that's right. But nobody, including McLuhan yet, has been able to translate that insight into something that can be communicated and put to use in the community.
Okay. Personally, after 13 years, coming up 14 years with ION, I think I'm the first to do it, and that was my reward. Non-physical showed up and gives me everything. That was what everybody was looking for. No, ION has kind of agreed with that. So, but we don't emphasize that here. I'm pretending I'm still pre-ION and talking to you. Pretending I don't know. But no, I actually have to deal with that point that ION says, you've done something that no one else did. And no one evoked non-physical where it talked to people. So that's an amazing point. Now, I can't find more than two people who believe that. You know what I mean? I'm a minority in appreciating ION that way. But anyways, I'll just put in the record here what I think about that, because in some way I talked myself into it. Talk. No one had ever had so much radio time as I did. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Nobody could. Yeah, couldn't. If you're a teacher, yes, you had classes, but you're constrained by the protocols of what you have to teach. There's a bit. There may not be too much freedom there. I've been on the radio, you know, since 1984, 40 fucking years almost, making shit up. And quoting the best of them on it. The other guys who are good at making shit up, like McLuhan. So no one has ever said as much as I did and engage a live audience for so many hours. So that's interesting. It's a new situation.
No, I agree. I agree.
Yeah.
It's a strange vocation.
That's right. Okay. So then McLuhan comes along in 1946, and you find his quote, in Footprints in the Sands of Crime, a very important essay, he says, the sailor in his story, The Maelstrom, that's Edgar Allan Poe's The Maelstrom, is at first paralyzed with horror. But in his very paralysis, there is another fascination which emerges, a power of detached observation. And you highlight the two words, detached observation. And I said to you, that's limited. Because later he would say detached and involved. He refined that. But he's a little simpler or hasn't said it enough. He just say it once, say, just getting to it, so it's new, so he's not mulling over, because later he thinks it over, notices it, oh, there's an involved aspect here. You know what I mean? That's my theory
You have to ask, in what time and at what place and in what expression is it possible to notice the importance of detachment and involvement? So
that would be an electric effect.
Yeah, that's right. You're absolutely right there.
Yeah.
So we can't say that detached observation has only one meaning. It has a Gutenbergian meaning. It has a tribal meaning. It has an electronic meaning.
And maybe so, an Asian meaning, you know, Buddhism and that stuff.
All kinds.
Yeah.
So then I would say here that when he says detached observation, he is not talking one-sidedly as if there were no involvement. Remember, this, the sailor in the maelstrom,
he's in paralysis.
Problem, Yeah, but yeah. He's involved.
Yeah, he's fascinated.
You cannot not be involved in the maelstrom.
Yeah, so there's the a fascination. His word fascination might be the clue.
Yeah, so if you are always already involved, if you're always already in the rearview mirror, where is the possibility of escape? And what he says is, well, this other fascination, as you underline, is the power of detached observation. And I would say the power of detached observation is simply creativity.
Yeah.
What McLuhan says.
Isn't that the individual consciousness responding to the environment just like it flips the image that comes through the retina? Remember we talked about how the stubbornness
absolutely.
Of the human does not accept what's given to him in the senses. He fucks with
right.
it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, cannot accept.
Right. That's the creativity.
So moment to moment to moment. Reimagination of the world around.
Yeah. So, what comes after detached observation? Have you got it handy there?
I don't have it handy, but I can. We can talk for a few minutes, and then I'll have it for you. No problem.
Yeah, because a power of detached observation. We should see what he adds to that.
Uh huh.
Maybe
sure,
it's
I'll
the,
get that.
Yeah. Okay.
But,
so yes,
ahead.
We're saying that this is the same thought as Wittgenstein's, or you're suggesting it's the same idea. Detached mm-hmm. observation is not involved in any thoughts or cultures or social communication, and that is the only way to survive. To enact a detached, involved observation. Or maybe not survive. It's the only way you can become a philosopher or someone that stands out among the regulars in the local tavern. Right?
Yeah, so McLuhan did think that it was the only way to survive, but he wasn't thinking individually. He was thinking of socially. And including the Society of Nations.
And so, that's really important. That's where he came up with the collective psychiatry, did he call it?
Maybe. I don't remember
yeah.
the phrase, but that sounds right.
Yeah, he said there has to be a not complex clairvoyance. That's another thing. Maybe that's two. But he did mm-hmm. say a collective kind of psychiatry in a sense of a detachment that psychiatric therapists claim to have, right? Some kind of collective detachment. And that would be everybody gets a lot of people, understand McLuhan, get a real understanding, and then see how that applies in their lives and what you would do politically. What laws would you pass, you know? Like Eric just mm-hmm. blatantly said, we realize that no inventor is going to inflict an invention on a society until it's fully debated, argued, and beat up. Before you
right.
allow it into the society, right?
Correct, correct. But I think what hasn't been seen in the McLuhan community, including not by Eric, or at least in my conversations with Eric, is that this question of going over an invention and figuring out what effects it might have and all that sort of stuff, this is the automatic work of science. So in the physical sciences, it would be very strange to phrase its working in the way that you were just quoting Eric. It's not as if a chemist goes into the lab and says, oh, here's a funny bunch of stuff. You know, I think I'll take a look at that or something. No, once science gets going, all stuff is part of what it's investigating, and it's investigating it in terms of laws. So a new invention will simply be part of the stuff that the science of media is looking at in a collective way that produces recognized results.
Yeah, that means the scientists, the traditional scientists in the lab or wherever, has to become aware of the science, the new science of media that's added to science, traditional science. It's a new development.
What McLuhan calls second science.
Is that what he calls the traditional science, second science?
No. The traditional science is first science,
mm-hmm.
and then what he proposes is second science. And so first science is the physical sciences that we have, starting with geometry and astronomy and things thousands of years ago, and then coming up through all of the sciences that we now have. But in those sciences, the key thing is to get away from human imagination or human overlay on the nature of things that you're looking at. You're trying to see how the things themselves operate, aside from mythologies or aside from stories
hype.
That are told in the tribe.
Or hype to sell the stuff.
Yeah. So then, exactly. So then what McLuhan says is, wait a minute, let's go back to Vico and to Bacon, and let's realize that part of what's going on in the world is human action. And so there's a whole new science that is not just the physical sciences, the first sciences that look at first nature. There's a possibility of a second science that looks at second nature, and that's a nature that includes human action. And so the reason that that's a science of media is that all human action is mediated.
Yeah, now you, I've never saw the term second science. Is that written by McLuhan somewheres?
I believe in laws of media.
Oh, okay.
But it's possible that I'm extrapolating from
second nature. Yeah, that, I've seen that. I think that's in laws of media. So,
yeah, it is, for
sure. Okay, so McLuhan told me through the Evergreens that nobody saw that he was a scientist, and that's what he was all about. Not an artist,
uh-huh.
even though he had to play that up when he first got famous and had to indicate something. He couldn't say he was a scientist yet, or he didn't want to. But you're right to say that he's a scientist, and he's adding it to science. Even their explanation of, well, okay, the scientists are angry at me not putting it into a scientific, not filtering it through scientific tradition. So, Eric, let's maybe first Barry Nevitt, let's ask a bunch of questions, or let's see if we can make it orderly and make it like a science. That's probably a bit too casual. He says,
definitely.
No, this is science, what I'm doing, what we're going to add to science, to traditional first science.
Well,
yeah,
it's actually a whole new science. So it's a quantum leap from what we think of as science to another kind of science.
Yeah, and he builds on, he completes sociology, psychology, anthropology, all the ologies, and makes a way to put it in order, and then has a new scenario anyways on top of putting it, the past in order. And whatever psychologists, sociologists, and anthropologists were looking for, he discovered what they got. What they were looking for, and then he said, we need to use this and take me seriously. This is a new thing. So,
which hasn't happened yet. That's what we're trying to instigate here.
Yeah, what I just said is not said in any biographies. Nobody says that. They don't get that.
Mm-hmm. Let me just tell you how the quotation from the Footsteps in the Sands of Time goes on, because it relates directly to what we're talking about here. So we say, in this very paralysis, there is another fascination which emerges, a power of detached observation, which becomes a scientific, in quotation mark, interest in the action of the Strom.
Wow.
And this provides the means of escape.
There's my uncanny psychic ability. I saw that coming. That's incredible. I don't remember that at all. He put scientific in quotes.
Yeah, and this is the last paragraph of the essay.
Wow.
For McLuhan, the first sentence and the last sentence of any essay are very important.
Yeah.
He always he always tried to say, sort of, here's the problem, and then the essay goes through its different paragraphs, and then the very end, here's my answer.
Yeah. And I was thinking, what he goes through between the first and last sentence is the antics. Remember that whole phrase? He had the antics of a highway or something? And he goes through the antics. Well, that's really, read it again. That's incredible. You got to send me that. I could type it up now, but I'm not. But I could look it up even. But and you said Sands of Time accidentally. It's Footprints in the Sands of Crime, which is important. Okay, so
that's a pun. Yeah.
And it's a pun.
By the way, when he sent it in, the Suwanee Review, Alan Tate was the editor.
Yeah.
And Alan Tate said, in reply, I'm not sure we can use this because the title is no good. He said, we have to find another title.
Wow.
And I think McLuhan answered, and he said, well, I actually like the title, but here's like five others you could use if you want, just so long as you publish it. But at the end, Tate agreed to keep the original title.
Good. So what happens? The power of detached... A power of detached observation.
Yeah,
comma.
Well, I'm sending it. No, I at least in the note that I have, there's no comma, but I could have just omitted it. So I don't want to say definitively, but it's the power of detached observation, which becomes a scientific interest in the action of the Ström, and this provides a means of escape. So
there it is.
If we,
very early. Very sneaky
early.
Guy. He throws that word in once. I don't think it ever shows up again for decades, right? In that context.
Yes, sir. Yeah, exactly.
And he puts it in quotes because it's first science. It's old science.
Notice how this goes back to his Nash thesis, where he talks about the intuitive perception of essentials. So what happens when the power of detached observation is activated, really it's just a squaring of what's always going on in human perception.
Yeah.
So when you retrace the labyrinth of human perception, you come down to creativity, which is to say pre-tribal awareness. And that pre-tribal awareness activates some possibility that is to emerge as tribal. That is to say, as he often quoted Eliot, he has to use words to talk to you, right?
Yeah.
So there's no such thing as being untribal.
Or undetached. But every human is looking, quote, paranoid state of what's going on.
Correct. Absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're all looking at each other, and then they go along with the ongoing train of, locomotive of communication that just never stops. And so you have different methods in the culture of how to drop off and officially do detached observation, even though you're always doing it, in mixed in with your involvement and responding to whatever the rules are of the tribe for what's being communicated. And that's irony and that's humor. If I'm talking to somebody in person, I can see in their eyes, there should be a twinkle about the absurdity of what we're doing, right? We're talking.
Yes, sir.
And sometimes people see that, or you get into a good conversation, eventually it gets to that point. And people report that when they, and I've seen it happen, people take marijuana back in the 60s, before they did all the later, more powerful stuff, they always ended up giggling. And I know that they were giggling because that awareness of the detached thing and the absurdity of canceling out the detachment when you're talking and you're forced to talk reduces people to laughter. What do you think?
Yeah.
You think that's it?
Yeah, I think that's a very good analysis. But they, when people were reduced to giggling, they were reduced to pre-tribal awareness,
yes.
You could say, but without being aware that that's what they were aware of.
Exactly. That was
right?
it.
So that's what McLuhan has to try to do, and I believe that's what Wittgenstein tried to do as well in a whole different way. But this is the great question that's hangs over humanity. are we going to be able to understand who we are?
Did you say who we aren't?
Are.
who we are, it might be okay.
Art works too.
Yeah. So that's right. That's where we're at today. And we've always been, but the stakes are higher. The media's got the edge on us. The social communication has congealed, crystallized into bizarre forms that are making people really forget their detached observation. They don't know how to get to it. And they actually have to drop the old forms of detached observation, which we're trying to say there's
correct.
A new way. And you can actually talk about it in the new scientific terms.
Yes, absolutely. That was well said.
Yeah, that's what we're doing.
What I would like to do, if it meets with your approval, is go back to the bottom of 130.
Yeah.
There's a very good quotation there from Cliché to Archetype. And then there's your discussion. And we went over your discussion a little bit last time. But I think that there's a lot of meat, M-E-A-T, in your discussion that we really didn't get to because we were kind of running out of time.
And it took a long time just to read through it.
That's right.
Yeah.
But I personally think that the quotation is very important. And then I think what you say is very interesting and relates directly to what we're talking about.
Okay, so you read the quote.
Yeah. So this is from Cliched Archetype by McLuhan and Watson. And what we have to do is we have to think of this in the terms that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
As to say detached observation, pre-tribal awareness, creativity, etc. So here we go. The expressionists had discovered that the creative process is a kind of repetition of the stages of apprehension. Now, I'll just stop there and comment for a minute. So McLuhan, especially between, say, 1945 and 1950, he came to the idea, I think largely through Mallarmé, that the whole point of art was to begin with any perception whatsoever and go backwards from that perception to its roots. And the roots of perception always, for McLuhan, lead back to creativity. That is to say that there has to be a kind of freedom at the very basis of all perception that activates that perception and not another one.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so...
Now, he says somewhere in Interior Landscape in an essay that the Catholic or the Christian believes that something comes out of nothing. That might be a pedestrian way to say.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So one of the things that I'm talking about in my recent posts is that for some reason, for the last 300 or 400 years, people have lost awareness that if something is actual, it must also be possible. Right. And so what does that mean? It means that if human beings are creative, let's say in art, there must be some basis for creativity in the reality of things. So underneath human being, as the ground of human being and human being understood as involving creativity, underneath human being, there has to be the possibility of creativity. And what is the possibility of creativity? It's creation out of nothing, as you were just saying.
Yeah. But that nothing is something. You're just going along there saying there is something at the root. And you're saying, well, that's creativity, but it's tactility. It's not a sense. It's a nothing. But it is
correct.
Something.
Or say, you could say, I instead of saying it's a nothing in the usual sense of nothing, I would say it's a expression. It's tactility in the sense of being in between. So you could say there's an original force, and then that original force is creative and ends up with creation. But the for McLuhan, that's to misplace what is actually first. What is actually first for McLuhan is not some force that then expresses itself. What is first is the expression. And the expression implicates the quote-unquote prior force and the creation. And he got that largely from Gil Sohn.
Gil Sohn, yes. Maybe you can't repeat your exact words before Gil Sohn, but would the original, what you call force, but then canceled that, is that everything is there at the beginning?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, he says that that's what all at onceness is, right?
Right. So that's why it's nothing. There's too much there to register.
Correct. Correct.
So then you're creative. You take an aspect of it and create something.
Yes.
It's always incomplete or biased or an angle.
Correct. It's always in the rearview mirror.
Yeah.
And from the rearview mirror, both of those.
Yeah, he does say, and you know that essay in the mid-60s, The Crack in the Rearview Mirror? He points out that all creativity comes from the rearview mirror, where most people think, oh, I don't want to be in the rearview mirror. That's obsolete. No, you've got to learn how to make the rearview mirror creative, right?
Correct, correct.
Yeah. Okay.
So, let me go on with the quotation here. So he says, repetition of the stages of apprehension, somewhat along the lines that relate Coleridge's primary and secondary imagination. So for the primary imagination for Coleridge is what originally activates. So in order to exercise imagination, so you imagine some scene or you imagine some dialogue or you imagine something that is going to be part of a poem or part of a play or something like that. In order for that imagination, which is secondary imagination, to be enacted, there has to be a kind of spark that's before that, but not before in chronological time, before in some, I don't know, a pre-tribal awareness time, you could say.
Yeah.
So by bringing in Coleridge's primary and secondary imagination, McLuhan is saying what the stages of apprehension are.
Yeah.
There's a primary spark, and then there are words, or then there is a perception, or then there is some action or emotion, right? So he then says, in the same way, there would seem to be an echo. An echo is a very important word for McLuhan in his later thought.
Yeah.
Seemed to be an echo of the formative process of consciousness in the entire content of the unconscious.
That would be the everything is in there in the nothing, the content of the entire content of the unconscious.
That's right. But included in the entire content of the unconscious is the process of apprehension.
Or the formative process of consciousness is in the unconscious.
That's right. So what he's saying there is that by turning the kaleidoscope in a certain way, we can become aware of what we are always doing. And when we become aware of what we are always doing, that enables a whole new science or sciences of the world that now includes human consciousness. So that's...
And that, okay, you said sciences? You said science twice.
Yeah, I said science and then sciences. Because when,
oh, plural.
A fundamental science becomes possible, it always generates subsidiary sciences.
That's right. So the, say it again, when a science becomes general, did you say?
No, when it becomes possible, when it manifests itself.
Then it what? What's the second part?
Then it generates subsidiary sciences.
Right. Okay. He says, the end of Take Today, the recently achieved forms of consciousness. What I'm getting from reading what you just read or following along, we have externalized that highest decibels of awareness where you are witnessing an environment that is doing an echo of the unconscious in the consciousness.
Correct.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course.
And that might be what I was getting at with the idea of the Android meme, and then something developed beyond that called the tech body. But there's something we can say and remember when we get later into where I'm trying to make the difference, distinguished. It's the idea that something is laid out in front of us. We're watching human consciousness merge with the global membrane, the macroscopic gesticulation, and it's acting out the way we should be right back at us.
Yeah.
Because it just news readers. I'm just like Tucker Carlson is always saying, look, I'm just telling you this stuff. It's up to you to decide what to make of this, you know? And It's kind of a cop-out, but on a basic level, the news is just telling you what is that you have to be creative with or react to. And so there's a detachment in the news dissemination process.
Yeah, an unrecognized one.
Yeah, what I'm saying is unrecognized.
Like
people are running around trying to tap into higher levels of awareness in all kinds of different forms, different cults, different just going back to school and taking courses, people do, you know, after working for many years. It's an attempt to tap into an environment of awareness, and they don't notice it's right there around them. As McCoon
Correct.
Said, you can stay home and observe this and be as aware as whatever the workshops are trying to create for you.
Yeah. It's like people have some kind of problem with their muscles. And so then they go to the gym and they exercise and they develop their muscles more. But it turns out that that makes the problem worse.
Yeah.
So these people that are trying to find in a cult or trying to find in some way, sort of a stability, all they're doing is exercising the Gutenberg galaxy.
Yeah.
So they're actually making their problem worse in the attempt to make it better. And
right.
when they do that, they more or less replicate the whole history of Western civilization. So that's the cul-de-sac that we're in.
Yes. And ALP, I laid out an interesting statement. ALP says, Bob, you are doing in baseball, it's a certain kind of a swing. It's called a full bunt. But anyways, he's, you know where people, they swing.
Yeah. Yeah.
They take a swing, and it hits, but it only goes as far as a bunt goes. So it's a full bunt swing. It actually, you know, you're in trouble. The guy catcher could throw you out real easily. So he's saying what I do is I full bunt swing into cul-de-sacs. I think he's been listening to us. He's taking our key word, throwing it back at me. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
But notice that lots of times people actually can beat out a hit like that, because when you take a full swing, the natural reaction of seeing that the swing has met the ball is to sort of take a step back and try and figure out, okay, is the ball coming to me or
yeah.
where is it going?
Where is
but
it?
In fact, the ball is going nowhere. Right?
That's right.
And so lots of times the catcher or the third baseman or the pitcher, they can't get to the ball.
Yeah.
And the guy ends up at first base, but his hit only went 2 feet.
Well, that's my response. Well, yeah, I may have been a full bus sweep, but I got to first base. Nobody knew
that's
what the
right.
fuck I was doing, and they couldn't see the ball. And I made
sure.
it.
Yeah, and then when they tried to catch it, first base, they overthrew, and then you got to second base. And when you got to second base, the throw from first base beamed the shortstop.
Hit the catcher in the head. Yeah, hit the catcher in the head. And knocked him out. But that's how I got the whole way. I was the first guy to get a home run from a full bunt.
Yeah.
I made it all the way home. Yeah. So that's another metaphor of what I've done.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So let me
continue with the quotation.
Yeah, but just what you've already said, let me just ask this. I don't know if it works. Is primary imagination, secondary imagination, first science and second science? Can we put them on either way?
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't work?
It's almost the reverse of that.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Primary is actually second, and secondary is first science.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay, so we can remember that. All right, go ahead.
Okay. So then, remember, we're talking about the formative process of consciousness in the entire content of the unconscious.
Yeah.
Right? So that says that within the unconscious, there is the capability and hence also the potential knowledge of what we're doing all the time, namely becoming conscious of whatever we're becoming conscious of. But
he says, in the same way they receive an echo, so in the same way, there's not that much of a difference between primary and secondary. They're hendites, one by means of two. Is that what you're getting at there?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's one by means of two, but it's also two by means of one.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of that's what the primary is the explosion or extension of the two. That is ignited by the primary one.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that primary one is not one of the poles. It's what's in between the poles. That's the difficult thing that most people don't get.
If early, almost still pre-tribal awareness, early societies, someone might recognize what they were getting bottled up in and then someone would say, well, there's, five people here. One, two, three, four, five. The shaman would say, wait a minute, now one ain't one. Now, you know what I mean? It's multiple.
Sure.
And then you can see when you get to writing and print, you lock the one in so solid, you get lost in thinking there's only one, or oneness in one.
Yes.
And then the electric gauge broke that up, brought back ambiguity, imprecision, and then a lot of the arts and sciences were retrieving that one was not one.
Correct.
Yeah.
So, but that's expressed linearly, right? So
yeah.
That's the linear story. But the non-linear story is what he says here. He says that in the same way there would seem to be an echo of the formative process of consciousness in the entire content of the unconscious. So what he's saying there is exactly what you just said in linear fashion.
Yeah.
And then he says it here in all at once fashion.
By saying it in three different sentences. They're each repeating.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Everything in this quotation is a repetition of what he just said.
That's right. Yeah.
But because he's trying to clarify, what he's talking about, even to himself.
Yes.
Right?
It's like he says something. And then there's echoes in the unconscious that comes conscious of, I have to say this other sentence to include that.
Mm-hmm. Right. But notice that what you said before is you said, well, here's this, there's tribal awareness, and then people lock up the one, for example, in geometry. Instead of taking all possible shapes, which they later would do in the 19th century, What the Greeks did was say, okay, here's what a circle is, right?
Yeah.
And here's what a square is, and here's what a triangle is. And that gave them a new scientific understanding of shapes and of landscaping and of many things, but it was achieved by locking in definition.
Yeah.
So you have a tribal awareness, and then you have literary awareness, and then you have the multiplication of that by Gutenberg, and then you have the overturning of that in the electric. But each of these is a formative process of consciousness, each one of them.
Yeah.
So what McLuhan is saying here is that they are all in the entire conscious, entire content of the unconscious, every one of them. So that's why when we come to the electric age, we have the possibility of seeing all of that for the first time, because we have understood correctly in the electronic age, we have gotten away from the poles of observation, and now we look at the in-between, the tactility of the poles. And that tactility is what he calls here the formative process of consciousness, and to become aware of that is an echo.
Right, and maybe being creative.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I had that thought. In the early social togetherness, to get stuck on the one as if it means one creates a leader. And then that gets institutionalized into kings, queens, and emperors. But, you know, they talk about Aboriginal societies. Someone is not a leader for all activities. They're only mm-hmm. good at fishing. So they lead when they go fishing. And then someone else takes over when they're building fires or something, right? They would
yep.
disperse. So it was more fluid because they hadn't got locked into one meaning only one. And
correct.
Then you get the beginning of hierarchy. So nowadays, nobody takes responsibility for everything because everybody else is involved, and there's not really any leaders. That's why the futility of a president or something is if that person is going to decide for everybody what's up. It's all on their shoulders. People have an awareness of cooperating in more, quote, dialogue in the electric age because the oneness, the literal interpretation of one that led to leadership or emperors, it got diffused in the 20th century.
But there's a great nostalgia for that.
Yeah.
Right? People think that in order to find their identity, in order to be who they are, they have to find that emperor of the I.
Right.
The ego emperor. But what they don't do is say that in order to be a person, in order to have an identity, you have to go with tactility. And
they don't say that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They don't see that.
Yeah.
And because they don't see that, they fight against the lack of stability that is, in fact, where they need to go and where they need to identify themselves.
Right. And I was just thinking, what is it that makes people nostalgic? That's another part of the main questions hanging over humanity. Why do we make that mistake? It's pretty hard to explain why humans do that. They just do it.
Well, first off, McLuhan didn't say all humans do it. He said that humans in the Western tradition have done that for 2,000 years. So,
and they made the mistake of imposing that modality on everybody, you know.
Yeah, but it wasn't only a mistake. That's the interesting thing. You see, there's all sorts of aspects of the Western literate tradition that McLuhan was trying to preserve.
Yeah, that's the special manufacture. By manufacture. Yeah, there's services in the duality, in the literate phase. So it becomes poetic. You look around and you end up like Alexander Pope at the end of his essay, What is Man? Or something, and he ends up saying, whatever is right. I understand that. You know,
yeah.
All this mistaken stuff, wars and all that, was not necessarily something we have to be ashamed of or to balance, which, like the feminists, they want to get rid of the patriarchy, you know. This is silly. You can't get rid of the media, and this is how McLuhan explained it. All media, once they're in an environment, you can't get rid of them. So we're stuck with the literate era. We just have to understand what it was. Its services,
yeah,
and disservices.
But
and
we don't...
Go ahead.
Well, we don't need to say that everything that happened was good, right? I mean,
yeah, we understand why it happened.
Yeah, but
yeah.
Also, I mean, a minute ago you said something like, so all of these wars and things weren't necessarily bad, but affirming part of the tradition doesn't mean affirming all of it.
Yeah.
Right? So I don't think McLuhan would say, you know, it was a good thing that Troy was destroyed and everybody was killed. I think he would say that good things came out of Greek civilization, but we don't necessarily want to repeat the whole thing.
Right. And I had a thought there. I have an update for Elliot when he says, I got to use words when I talk to you.
Uh-huh.
I got to use words. And also, you won't give me 2 hours to explain what I meant. See,
yep.
People don't, it's always pretty fast, the interaction, especially in person. So if I say something, and if they were talking in this environment, that person would have to say to me, like you do, and quote, correct what I say, add to the other meanings to retrieve the polarity that I canceled by saying something.
Uh-huh.
You get that? And so people do not allow you, having a time to always be multiplying what you had just said to make sure everybody knows that nothing was really said there. You get into efficient causality. There are things people think have to be done. Now, then that becomes debatable about what needs to be done. Do you really need 3 meals a day, you know? There's lots of people who don't need 3 meals a day, so can't make that a rule. And then you might not need as much money to have on your expense account, you know, if you live frugally. So that is, you could say that is what people are always engaging. They're always adjusting themselves to, you could say, the future, but it's part of the present, of where I could improve on this. But I have to deal with my past, which is right there with me in the now, are my mistakes. And your present is the tactile no place. Like there is no present. Just there's no past or future. There's nothing. And you have to adjust that. So McLuhan makes a big deal out of the word adjustment in War and Peace in the Gold Village, talking about the Book of Tea and the way Oriental arts are or Asian arts are, right? They're adjustment.
Yeah.
The point of adjustment. And that gets into your sensory ratios. So, but you don't have time. You're not allowed to talk like this. in normal interaction, because there's other things that have to be done, supposedly.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and so
you get that's a new idea there. Not only do I got to use words, you won't give me time to explain the disservices of the words I use to you.
Right. So one of the implications of science, the way McLuhan was thinking about it, is that that problem kind of disappears. Wittgenstein said that the whole point of philosophy was to make problems disappear. They don't get answered. They just don't appear as problems anymore.
Mm.
So if you think of, just think of chemistry for a minute. Everything that's going on in our bodies, in our houses, outside the houses, everything is chemistry. But if we go to the store to pick something up, we're not thinking about chemistry. It just, chemistry is what is going on. It's sort of in the background, and people can study it and all of that sort of stuff. So this problem of not having the time to explain, the problem of multiple meanings, the problem of all of the difficulties of communication, all that stuff. For McLuhan, those problems should disappear. They don't get answered into some sort of cloud of unknowing or mystic insight or something. They just, because we have the answer to those things, they are there in the same way that chemistry is there. We still go to the store. We still talk on the phone. We do whatever we're doing, but we're in a whole new environment. And that whole new environment is the medium that is the message.
So if you get cut off and you can't finish, it'll get resolved or not become an issue because of subsequent events that you've set up by the little bit you did say. So people are resolving a lot all the time in the sense of it's not a problem anymore in the interval.
Yeah, but that's sort of a hint of the way it could be, right? The thing about this new science is that it gives a it lends a whole new aspect to language. So people won't have the same kinds of problems, and they won't have the same kinds of demands. It'll be a different world in an analogous way to how the world has changed from 1800.
Mm.
Right? The world in the last 200 years is just completely different from the world that was before that. And so McLuhan isn't trying to say, okay, I can see this new world and it's going to be all great and all that stuff. All he can do is suggest that we become aware of ourselves in a new way and then follow the science.
Yeah.
You can't do anything else.
And it's being done.
Yeah, well, we're trying to get there. Let me give you a quotation from The Medium is the Massage, because you asked maybe 5 minutes ago, how did we get here?
Yeah.
And I thought of this quotation from Medium is the Massage. He says, ours is a brand new world of all at onceness. Time has ceased. Space has vanished. We now live in a global village, a simultaneous happening. We are back in acoustic space. We have begun again to structure the primordial feeling, the tribal emotions from which a few centuries of literacy have divorced us.
And, is that implying pre-tribal awareness there when he says primordial?
I think he is. But, but notice that what he elsewhere calls pre-tribal awareness, here he calls tribal emotion.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is funny. But
language and social rules try to balance off the emotion.
That's right.
Or control
it. So what he calls here the primordial feeling is pre-tribal awareness. So I remember in one of our conversations, maybe two or three ago, you said that he didn't seem to get into pre-tribal awareness very much in between his Nash thesis and then 1970 when he suddenly begins to talk about pre-tribal awareness. But then we said, well, maybe he did speak about it, but he spoke about it in different terms.
Yep.
And I think that's right. So
we have found a lot. You found a lot of cases where he did do it, did say it.
Yeah. And here he talks about the primordial feeling.
Yeah.
And I think that is pre-tribal awareness.
Yeah, because he'll only say that once. When he says rare phrases like scientific in that from 1946 mm-hmm. in that context, that's him pointing to something because he'll never say it like that again. He'll always repeat the definition of visual space and the stuff he always kept repeating. But you come up to a primordial emotion. I don't know any other place he ever said that. Use those two words. So that stands out.
Yep.
Maybe you could make an inventory. A PhD could make an inventory, or maybe just a master's, of all the one-time shots that he did.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I'm convinced. I don't want to sort of blow my own horn here or something, but...
no, don't do that around me, buddy.
But some in the future, if we have a future, I predict that a very large number of PhD theses will take some post of mine and say, okay, let's investigate this, you know, throughout McLuhan's work.
Yeah.
Because what I'm doing, and I think it's kind of a reflection of what McLuhan was doing, is human beings, when they're really thinking, they can't do anything more than sort of ignite sparks.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what you do on the radio all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the bureaucrats of the spirit come along later and they do their PhD thesis or they get their tenure or whatever they're going to do. And basically they take one or two sparks from somebody that generated a million of them and they create a career out of that.
Yes.
So I think that is what's going to happen. So people will come along, they'll see the phrase here, the primordial feeling, the tribal emotion, and they'll, just as you suggested, they'll go through the whole
corpus
and they'll find synonyms for those things.
Yeah, those words. They're never repeated.
Yeah, and then they'll be given the Order of Canada, and they'll be...
and you'll send a letter to the editor, that's not what you meant! Yeah, you got to put a warning every now and then in your blog. Listen, what you think I'm saying is not. Don't, if you make a PhD out of this, that's a big distraction. So what, that's why we call our colleagues, fuck you, university. You know, that our discussions on Wednesdays without Ion on the radio. You know about that?
Oh, yeah?
Me and Clinton.
No.
Yes, me, Clinton,
no,
Greg Duffel and Brian and Craig and Chad. Have a discussion, and Clint and I bring in a lot of McLuhan. Greg's a blatant communist; he wants to go live in North Korea. Brian's an underground Gnostic, and he knows very much about subcultures. And then Chad's very good on computers and modern technology. So it's quite a unique mixture. And now, why was I bringing this up? We call ourselves Fuck You University.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we announce everybody's got their degree. I think we do that. Clinton wrote up something. It's at the top. It says, you already got a degree. You already graduated. Now get down to work here. We don't want anybody making other crap like you just complained about as a result of what we're doing. Just call in and participate.
Clinton is back in the group. I think you said that he had dropped out.
Yeah, because his mother died, and he had to deal with a lot of stuff there. So he came back, but he's becoming a bureaucrat. He's getting projects that he says should go somewhere well for him. So he's only coming in every second show. He didn't come every week. He didn't get time. So, yeah, I got him to compromise, because he basically didn't really want to do it anymore, even though he would miss it. But he thought what he had stumbled into was way more important. But I said, no, nothing's more important than this dialogue. So,
he's into stuff where people think he's intelligent and creative, right?
He's getting an identity.
Of course,
he was
that's
a nobody.
More important.
Yeah, he was a gay Canadian gay beer salesman. Gay beer salesman is what he's been doing for years, and he was very frustrated because he knew. He missed dialogue, intelligent talk, there was no place there for him other than on the internet, and he did that all his life, so he was sick of that. So he decided to get back to reading and not doing the internet so much, and so he got isolated doing that until he read that long thing on the literary classroom about Walls, or whatever that thing is I did. I did an inventory of all the postmodern people. It's a very long thing. What's it called? Classroom, the literary aesthetics of the American Classroom Without Walls. Anyways, I show how McLuhan did everything that all the POMO guys say later. He read that. Not many people read it, and he got in touch with me. So I told him, hey, I'm doing a radio show in 2 hours. Call in. And he called in. That's like back in 2016, a long time ago, 15, 16. And because I saw that he was interesting. He could talk, and now he is where he is because he applied engagement with me, and then that allowed him to meet other people, and one thing led to another, where now he has access to the McLuhan archives that nobody else has access to. He's got permission.
Yeah.
But because he recognized, he'll say, if he has to explain it to the know-nothings, he says, well, I was very lost in the internet world, the computer world, and decided to get mm-hmm. back in my body. And that led me to McLuhan, who seemed to be writing about that, mm-hmm. trying to preserve mm-hmm. the body. And then he was lucky to meet me. I stimulated him, and then now we're doing this university.
Right. But he has to, as I've told Clinton, he has to get more into tactility. This attention to the body, it is very easily becomes one-sided.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, most of the trends today are a massive anthropomorphic physical projection into the multi-bodied, and people are trying to get back into the body through MAGA, is one expression, and whatever else, their outrage at yeah. transgenders is another aspect, or people becoming transgenders because they're trying to figure out the body. Yeah, you've got to drop the body, which is the service of the electric media.
Yeah.
There's a good point. The whole thing, the electric virtual thing is is an anti-environment to your natural tendency to stay into your surplus flesh, lazily.
Mm-hmm. And is that the anthropomorphic physical?
Yeah, projecting some image of what you think humans are from previous cultures. I often say it's the detachment. Anthropomorphic physical is the world's out there, but it's not me. But you have to deal with your natural inclination to look for the world being you.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
it's a mixture of what we were just saying. Anthropomorphic physical is detached observation.
And
interplay.
So I would, tell me if I'm wrong here, I would say that that's what might be called the negative echo.
Yeah.
And why is it the negative echo? Because it's an echo that goes back and forth between the problem of isolation and detachment and the problem of the real world. It's going back and forth, and it's unable to find stability in either the one pole or the other pole.
Yeah, you didn't say the other pole is more like merger.
Well, yeah, I mean...
involvement, whatever you call being stuck in the mandates of communication that imposes stuff on you.
So you have the condition of the echo going back and forth between sort of two false choices.
Yeah.
And if you then analyze what's going on there, you can say that people are looking for merger, but they can't find it, or looking for matching, but they can't find it.
Because you're not just that.
Of course. So the whole problem is to give up what you think is orientation, namely the search for matching.
And explore that pain is not necessarily tragic.
Absolutely. Well, pain is, in the sense that we're talking about, pain is actually a signpost.
Yeah, you're getting somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay, so
that's
what?
Right, maybe.
Okay, so we were saying, so anthropomorphic physical, you remember you have the quote from Keats, negative capability. The anthropomorphic physical is, so in my chart, I've got five sections, but I discuss them as four quadrants. And the fifth is the Dobbs quadrant, which is the fifth of four, but it's because I'm inside each one.
Right.
And to the degree I cooperate with each quadrant, I'm saying that's me. That's anthropomorphic physical. Mm-hmm. I'm letting into me.
So you're in them, but also they are in you.
And they don't know it the way I present uh-huh. the chart, because I put myself yeah. in the winner's circle. You know, I'm the guy who's floating in and out, right? Rumpelstiltskin.
Yeah, yeah.
And but I'm I don't see any advantage in accepting the trophy when I get in the winner's circle.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I reject the trophy. Give it to someone else, some other dupe who wants to be number one. So
yeah,
the
yeah. And, that's what, and notice be number one relates to what we were talking about earlier of the one, right?
Number one is
Gutenbergian, right?
That's
exactly what the Gutenberg galaxy wants.
And that's what all the mystics are saying. You know, you're in this world, but not of it. You know, don't get carried away with what you think is going on. Always
yeah.
be ready to find out, oh, I didn't realize that ain't going on. That solves that problem. So I would say that I'm good at doing that, though I'm also don't want to get too good at it. Still got to be a doofus, you know. You don't want to be number one.
That's because antics are an essential part of human beings.
Yeah. Yep. So we're doing a very good job of summing up by words what's going on. As I think ALP said about our recent, and we've done some really good recordings recently, he said, it's obscure, Bob. we're being obscure. No?
When you said ALP before, I thought you were talking about Finnegan's Wake.
No, I'm talking about a person.
Ah, okay. So who is it?
Well, it's Jim. He online, he's known as Anna Livia Plurabelle.
Ah, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's his name. And you know Jim, good friend
of
yours.
Of course.
Jim is ALP. So he made the first criticism, whatever it was, at the beginning of this dialogue. What was it? I'm a bunt. I'm a full bunt swing. Or full swing bunt, whatever the phrase was. And now the second point he comes up is he says we're being obscurant or obscure. So what?
But the matter at stake is obscure.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? There's no getting around obscurity in human being.
Yeah, it's silly to demand clarity to the extent that you don't include obscure. You must include the failure. Remember, McLuhan talks and takes today about, you know, there's no success like failure and no failure like success.
Yeah. But look at the human beings need to sleep.
Yeah.
Right? They need to, they breathe, but there's breathing out and there's breathing in, and there's the switch in between them is not either one. So there's a kind of obscurity in breathing, and then speech is stuttering. So there's a obscure border in the stutter that allows language. So human beings are not even thinkable without obscurity.
Right. So humans instinctively know that. But then they meet somebody who can talk a lot, like a professor.
Yeah.
And they get thrown by that. They think, oh, I can't talk like that. I should. And they don't know if they learn to talk like the professor, they'd end up back with their intuition they already had, which is, nothing's complete here. Yeah. I like Krishnamurti. He said, the truly religious person is incomplete. And most people think if you're being religious, you're going to get complete.
Yeah.
So that's a good aphorism. It's interesting. Alan Watts used to say, we mentioned him, anybody who comes to him, he says they're a Buddha or ascended, some complimentary point, they're enlightened, and pretending they're not. And so he looks at everybody and says, I'm not being fooled by you pretending you don't get it.
Uh-huh.
And that's a good attitude. I think Ayn said that great healers, they work on people because they consider the person already healthy, already healed. And that somehow imparts in their method. So so you have to remember you didn't do it.
Yes. But the problem with Watts is the reason that he was saying that is that he would say something like, there is only now.
Yeah.
Right? And so the now is inherently screwed up, problematic, and all that sort of stuff. So then you get to what you were just talking about. But
yep.
The presupposition is wrong. This idea that there is only now, that's only part of all-at-onceness. As McLuhan is trying to think all-at-onceness, it's not just now, it's all nows, plural.
Right. So, what was I going to say? Watts's language in the Western world was new. Like he had a book titled, This Is It! It's interesting, you go back and you see each guy who made it into the canon, Shakespeare, they go through the playwrights or go through the poets, go through the philosophers, each one added something. And there were what McLuhan said on page 31 of Counterblast, I think it is, I think that's where he said it, they were temporary anti-environments,
mm-hmm.
only useful for a while because they hadn't been heard yet. So it's almost like we're, over the next million years, every possible thought, every possible noise will be created, and they'll all be finite. And so the new person, the new creative person comes along and drops what everybody thought was new. Now they recognize before anybody else, it's not new anymore. We got to make something new here. And so they'll come up with a bunch of words or movies or TVs or shows or virtual environments that you'll be sucked into. That will be appeared to be new, and that'll be a temporary anti-environment. And then McLuhan said on page 31 that what we have for anti-environment now is a rapid series of innovations. That's the only anti-environment possible, and it's an ersatz anti-environment. So he's saying that by the global membrane time, we didn't have a way to have an anti-environment. So that was a new idea. So then he wrote on that point, and it appeared to be new. He was a temporary anti-environment with the idea that there was no more anti-environments. Are you with me?
Yeah, I'm with you, but I'm trying to think through.
You're trying to recover from the onslaught of sound.
No, I think it's interesting, but the way I try to dialogue with you is I try to say, to myself that I need to sort of go back, be an echo of what Bob said,
yeah.
To mine, M-I-N-E, to mine what is in there,
yeah.
to make sure that I understand it. And once I understand it, then I can say, well, I agree or I don't agree.
Are you aware of that quote on page 31 where he says, a rapid series of innovations is an ersatz anti-environment. Had you thought much about that quote?
No, I haven't.
Yeah,
I haven't.
So that's why you have
why
to think about
I
it.
Need to,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I need to, thinking for me means to clutch, put in the clutch, and to ruminate over.
Well, retrieve the stages of apprehension. You're going to want to replay them.
Correct. Yeah.
So that's page 31 of Counterblast. Want to see
mm-hmm.
it. Okay, so we didn't do the third sentence yet.
That's right. That's right. And just before I read that third sentence, let me read once again the passage from The Medium is the Massage, right? So he says, ours is a brand new world of all-at-onceness. Time has ceased. Space has vanished. We now live in a global village, a simultaneous happening. We are back in acoustic space. We have begun again to structure the primordial feeling, the tribal emotions, from which a few centuries of literacy have divorced us. And by the way, earlier, that is to say in 1954, in Five Sovereign Fingers Tax the Breath, he has that same sentence, but with a different total of years. He says, in 1954, as opposed to 1967 for the medium as the massage, 54, he says, we are back in acoustic space. We begin again to structure the primordial feelings and emotions from which 3,000 years of literacy have divorced us. So he, in 67, he thought, well, I'll just take it back to Gutenberg. And in 1954, he took it back to Homer.
Right, and he said, Hendiades, he said, primordial emotion and feelings. He split it up.
Yeah.
Now, what was I going to say about that? Nobody defines the global village as a simultaneous happening. You ask them to imagine a global village, they'll just think of, oh, everything is visible. I can get there, fly there real fast. I can talk on the phone. They have all these maybe gadget images in their mind of the global village and how it's supposedly tinier. They don't think of it as a simultaneous happening. And I've never noticed that before. That's his definition of a global village.
And the reason that the simultaneous happening is not does not strike people is that everybody has a very singular notion of time. And if you have a singular notion of time, then you really can't understand simultaneity.
Yeah, you think that it means, global village means there's less time to get someplace. It's linear. Get there real fast.
Yeah.
Get there the same day.
Yeah, so time is all linear, and so the simultaneous happening is conceived of as, well, everything that's going on now. But that's not what McLuhan means by all-at-onceness or simultaneity. What is going on now is first and foremost what is in the unconscious.
And you're actually everywhere at once, electrically, on the phone.
Yes, absolutely. And so it's like the unconscious is a piano, and everything that's going on are different songs and melodies that are being played on the piano.
Yeah.
So the people think that the global village is all of the songs and melodies. But that's not what they are. They are the dynamic extension of the piano, and the piano is the unconscious.
Yeah, remember how I explained the one and the four? One is the global membrane, four is the different states that people get into. Simultaneous happening. Simultaneous is the one, and the happenings are the four. The happenings go through tetrads. And I reduce the four to, well, all of the happenings to four, schizophrenia, paranoia, hysteria, panic, and ecstasy, which is actually five. But the that's what 1-4 means, simultaneous happening. It's global and a village. It's two things. It's simultaneous and a happening, two different phenomena. It's a mosaic.
Sure. Yeah. So it's at the end of the day, and to come to terms with that, you need to come to terms with tactility.
Yeah.
That's what is the bridge.
And it's not a sense, which means it's not any characteristic you put into smell, sight, kinesis, or hearing, or movement. And so within sight, that means there's no linearity. There's no sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, depending on the take on tactility, the senses are each of the senses is very different in meaning. So, for example, when McLuhan says that television is tactile, It's always been confusing to people that you have something that appears to be very visual, and McLuhan denies that it's visual. The same thing when he says that symphonic music is visual. Again, people say, well, wait a minute, that's just a sound, right? And what's the reason for this? The reason is that the senses, each of the senses is not one thing. That's the Gutenbergian hang-up, is to attempt to establish stability.
Yeah, Aristotle's categories.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
The categories don't work. And McLuhan says blatantly, there are no subjects anymore. They don't work.
Correct. Right.
And that's what Finnegan's Wake showed.
Mm-hmm.
He had the interplay of all the subjects. So the interplay, that's simultaneous happening. Interplay.
Yes. Yeah, you could say that. Yeah, so you could say it's common sense. You could say it's synesthesia. You could say it's many things. You could say it's the medium that is the message.
Yeah. And you're in two places at once.
Yeah.
You're an electron.
Yeah.
It's interesting how he takes quantum physics and says, well, those guys are just trying to visualize what can't be visualized anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So who, there's a lot of people looking around saying, we don't need these institutions as people thought they were. That's a big problem. That's like potential anarchy. But then I'd have to say, no, it's being resolved by the way people are living in a world where you can't have jobs, you can't have money, just on welfare, and looks like it's going to get blown up any day. That's how we live now, on the edge.
Right. we call that living.
Yeah. And we got to give up living. Give it up a little bit.
Yeah, well. We'll see, right? All of the institutions that are under attack are fighting back. That's what's going on right now.
They're the animals.
Yeah.
Page 190 in War and Peace. The animals have taken over the role of first nature, the old animals. The new animals are everything that we supposedly value, culture, civilization, order, a decent society, progress, make sure your kids get to college or get somewhere similar. All that is not there anymore. None of it. You know, you know what a popular expression of that? You see it in commentary. Every damn profession is a sham now. There's nothing but, Chad was saying this on the show today, there's not one, quote, honest profession anymore. They're all struggling, and they have to make up crap more and more to be viable or to pretend that you need to have something to do, to be done, to make money. So more and more the world's confronting that they can't have money anymore. What's money? It's time. Time's linear. Money's linear. And you have technologies that are offering everything for free. Like, you know, what does Facebook do? They make wealth out of grabbing what's free, your personal data, and then giving it to other institutions who agree, yeah, this is very valuable. We need to know about everybody. We need to make profiles and be able to target everybody. That's bullshit, but that's what runs the economy now. That's the knowledge that supposedly Silicon Valley dominates, right? The gathering of pattern recognition from trivial details about chemical bodies and what environments they consume. It's almost a conspiracy. You say, well, okay, we are here. Everything can be free. We are just an environment that's free. How are we going to fit ourselves back into the Western linear tradition of property and money and identity? Okay, well, let's pretend that what people post on Facebook, and back then it was MySpace, you know, way back there in 2002, and we'll pretend we're trading that. And they agreed, okay, let's pretend that's the economy. And every other profession had to line up with that and gradually adapt to it and accept it as the economy, and then they turn it into a problem so that Congress would have a job to police these guys. But they couldn't police them because nobody – Zuckerberg says, I don't know what really goes on at my company. I don't understand this thing completely. And the congressman says, yeah, you're not explaining very well. We don't understand. There's a great big lack of understanding of ability to be articulate in the old-fashioned way, Gutenberg way, and therefore you get two phases of the president, the leader, the one. First guy couldn't finish his sentences, second guy couldn't finish his syllables. And that's where we are today. Leadership, where nobody could agree that anything has been substantially said. And the figure of that is Ukraine, right? Run by a comedian who is pretending he's leading something, and we need to give money to some place so it can be recycled back to us, so we give it to them. Boy, it's there's lots of fodder for comedy there. Are you there? Did you disconnect? I think you disconnected. So we'll leave that monologue in there, and I will reconnect with just a minute, I'm getting an echo there. Yeah, I think we've disconnected. So let me reconnect with who was I talking to? Cameron, right. Okay. Let me see if there's an echo.
Hello.
Yeah, it's coming through that one. So let's assume. Okay. So what I did, I was going on and did a little bit of a rant, and I didn't know that no one was listening, and you didn't know why. Well, I wasn't hearing you.
Correct.
So we went into.
I heard you until the end. I heard you go right down to.
You hear me say? Ask. Did you hear me say? So who was I talking to?
Yes. And then after, I heard you say after a while, oh, it must have been Cameron.
Yeah, yeah. I eventually remembered your name. Yeah. I got so involved in my own language and lost my detachment. Okay, so I think we're back in and all that got recorded.
Maybe. Okay, well, we'll see.
So let's see. We've been going almost 2 hours, so we still have time, but let's do the third sentence. What were you telling me?
I was telling you that what you were talking about related to McLuhan in 1950 and then in 1960. So in 1950, he was already talking about consumers as producers.
Yeah.
Right? And you were talking about how MySpace and
got used
to produce wealth out of what the consumers were doing with it. And then later you were talking about the sham that has taken over the world, where there's no position that's not sham, and that's McLuhan's global theater, where all there is roles. So somebody says, I'm the president, somebody else says, I'm the secretary of state, and they go about their business.
Yeah, so that's 1960, and 1950, he had different terms. Producer, I think he said.
Yeah.
And then roles.
The producer the consumer as producer.
Yeah.
So he already saw in 1950 that polls were sort of the new information environment.
And then he called it roles 10 years later. He started emphasizing that word. Okay, so what if
we
I was talking and you couldn't hear me, and you were talking, I could hear you.
You couldn't hear me.
Okay, so were you recorded?
Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know what happened there. And it may have stopped. The recording may have stopped, even though when one other phone, which we have hooked in here, is going, that means it should be still recording. But I don't know. So let's do the third sentence, and it may or may not be recorded.
Okay. So just remember from the last part that I was talking about from the messages, the massage, he's talking about the new world of all-at-onceness, a simultaneous happening, and he's talking about we're trying to structure the primordial feeling, the tribal emotions. So if we go to the third sentence, he says, this in turn, the fact that the formative process of consciousness in the entire content of the unconscious, he says, this in turn implies a close liaison between private and corporate awareness. So the fact that private awareness, that is to say pre-tribal awareness, goes together with corporate awareness relates back to the formative process of consciousness. Well, why? Because in order to form consciousness, you have to go into the unconscious, which is to say the corporate, and you have to exercise the private, the pre-tribal, to select out of that and to activate out of that.
Correct.
So are you there? Yeah, you're there. Okay, good.
Though which exerts the most effect on the other may depend entirely on the degree of awareness achieved.
Correct. So there he's saying that the genesis of history depends upon the kind of awareness that we have on that process. So the whole Gutenberg galaxy is a kind of suspension of that process. The Gutenberg galaxy, in order to attain the efficiencies that it did, had to abstract from the fact that the pre-tribal awareness and the collective awareness in the unconscious are tremendously vague because they're so large. They're amorphous because they're sort of before the form, that is to say, before the morphe. So these things are amorphous in the Gutenberg galaxy. They become formed and therefore very efficient, very scientific in one sense, and so all sorts of progress can be made. But so that's one kind of awareness achieved. But there are other kinds of possible awareness, and that's what McLuhan wants to sort of ignite, is a new degree of awareness on what's going on between the private and corporate awareness.
Yeah. And then it gets tricky where he doesn't know where the medium differs from the message, and that's what he's saying. You get you don't know which is affecting which.
Yes.
And then the degree of awareness achieved, that would be the degree of proportions about the factors that are making you think one way or the other. And you delineate the figure ground of the proportions of categories. And to the degree you can complexify it and talk it in a complicated way, you got awareness.
Correct. So one of the things, to use the language you just used, one of the things he's talking about here is that there is always private and corporate awareness. So you could say there's always figure and ground.
Yeah.
But one of the possibilities in ground is that ground be forgotten. That's a perennial possibility for humans, is to ignore or deny the ground. So the whole of Gutenberg galaxy gets generated out of that possibility of ignoring, that possibility of creating an efficiency by forgetting about the ground.
So that was the experiment. That was an attempt to live in that kind of exaggerated unawareness.
Yes. So in the sense that you're using, all human activity from the beginning to the end is an experiment or a probe. And I think you often talk about probes as being the essence of human activity.
Yeah, we're always, what do they call it? They say the present dilemma in Ukraine and between the powers is existential.
Mm-hmm.
It's the existential part of living. You're probing all the time. You're inventing,
yeah, well,
you're creating.
Yeah. When the word existential is used in a different way in politics and war than it is in philosophy.
Yeah.
So in terms of Ukraine, the existential danger for Russia, for Ukraine, for NATO, for everybody is that the war could cause them to cease to exist. That's the existential danger.
Yeah, there comes a war that wipes everybody out. So,
mm-hmm. It could just wipe out one or the other.
Yeah. Now something has shifted, so that people can talk about nuclear war as an option. Never was that really discussed before. Now, and this shocks a lot of people. They'll say what I'm saying. How can they be talking about nuclear war as maybe something we could do? You know,
mm-hmm.
So what that means, the action is shifted to somewhere else, because it does. We're not afraid of that. We're afraid of something else, but we aren't pointing it out. And what we're afraid of is nothing more can be determined to have arrived at anything, because every institution or form of expression fails to communicate. And so we want to get something that establishes something has happened, and nuclear war is what we got, because that's big enough to cover how big the world is today, or how imploded it is, or how tiny and merged it is. Those factors make the acceptance of nuclear war, and as Tucker Carlson's always saying, there's no peace process. Nobody's faking an attempt to have a peace process. They always did that before, apparently, and now they're saying they don't. So you have to be detached to discuss the public panic about nuclear war being discussed as an option. If you have the comprehensive awareness, you can talk about it like I'm just doing right now, which would probably say, people would say, that's nuts. He's over talking something that's a terrible threat. They want to keep it back to a threat. But I'm saying, no, there's something different that is the bigger threat. Where we've actually gotten that we can't accept. We can't accept it. What?
I couldn't hear you, and I don't know if you could hear me for the last minute.
It happened again.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what am I?
We might as well keep on going, because we're either still recording or we're not.
Well, we should come to an ending point here.
Okay.
So
let me just say, in regards to people saying we shouldn't be afraid of nuclear war and stuff, that's a new kind of advertising. What that tells us is that the entire scene in Ukraine, this war that's killing hundreds of thousands of people and destroying all of eastern Ukraine, that this isn't some kind of accident. This isn't something that happened out of the blue. In the same way that nuclear war may be a option, according to the latest advertising in the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or something like this, for the same reason that people want us to think that maybe we should turn to nuclear weapons, those same people are engaged in furthering the war in Ukraine rather than negotiation, let's say, out of a sense of desperation. So the deep state in some way has reached such a state of desperation that one of the weapons they want to now deploy is to propagate the notion through media advertising that maybe nuclear weapons would be a good idea. It's total insanity, but it tells us that the deep state is feels that it is going to need to show its face because of its desperation. Yeah, exactly. We don't know why it's so desperate. We don't know how it's become obsolete, even in its own mind. All we know is that that has happened.
Yeah, and I am attempting to explain what it is they're frightened of. Their function and every other anthropomorphic function is obsolete now because mm-hmm. we've come to a kind of completion.
That's the sham.
That's their sham. You mean, that's what they can't accept.
Before, how nobody has.
Yeah, their profession is obsolete.
Identity.
Yeah. You know, George Bernard Shaw said every profession is a conspiracy against the layman. Well, that's been exaggerated with Baroque spirals of endless wealth in every possible institution and new institutions. There's been a great creativity in making professions and roles for people, but it's flipped. Now there's no role for anybody to figure out. Well, the kids can't find a role to fit themselves into. They refuse to participate in whatever roles are being offered. They see that, no, that's not the issue. Because mm-hmm. the amazing environment of the matrix, the internet, social media is perfect communication, which we began with. It is this paragraph that we're analyzing manifested. We are both detached and involved to the most maximum amount. It's like saying, that star is 10 billion miles away. Oh, no, no, it's 40 billion. What's the difference? You don't know the difference. we have extended ourselves to a kind of completion that we can't figure out how to fit our identity to.
Correct.
Into it.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's like... it's like fame. Once fame becomes something that you can manufacture, then it's over.
Yeah.
There's no use to having fame. And money is like that now. You can create $1 trillion or something because you can catch a ball or because you can kiss somebody on a screen or something. And you get all that money and then you have nothing to do with it. I mean, it's useless because it's manufactured.
Yeah. So young kids, they want to become famous, but they make strategies that they aren't bothered by it. They don't lose their private identity. They don't want to let anybody know where they are. There's so mm-hmm. many disservices in being famous that you lose your ability to have a relaxed, anonymous existence for every now and then.
Mm.
So they don't want to be traditionally famous. And I was just looking at a bunch of people, a list of billionaires, and a lot of the pictures are walking around in very casual clothes. They're not like the 19th century with Victorian, highbrow costumes on. Like they're totally indifferent. You see, I merely thought these people have nothing to buy. They got too much money. It's meaningless. And so they walk around looking for simple little things that don't cost anything to do.
Yep.
Yeah, so there's so McClune once said that obsolescence is he said everything's becoming obsolescence, but then he said obsolescence is obsolete. So I think the last 40 years, the digital era, was, I think Barry Nevin used to say, we did what we never needed to do. We didn't have to have a digital era. If we had Eric McClune in charge at the United Nations, we wouldn't have had it. But we did have it, and it showed everything being useless. It was a squaring of the process and a needless sham of achievement in every profession, where in actuality every profession is failing. Where's law? Where are the cops? they're not even around, at least mm-hmm. in the States. So
everywhere.
Right. So the
it's an unmasking of the Gutenberg galaxy
and the electric galaxy in some way.
Well, the Electric Galaxy has sort of two possible faces. It's either the loss of everything or the gain of everything. It's like McLuhan at the end of the Christian Humanism lecture in 54. He says it's either the top of Mount Purgatory or the abyss.
And it seems that you're left to figure it out for yourself, because none of the tribal means of giving you comfort and what the conclusion is, who won, works anymore. We're back to pre-tribal awareness.
Yeah.
This is the real McLuhan point we're coming out, the new point. What we retrieved was pre-tribal awareness or, mm-hmm. as Croker says, post-information society.
Yeah. But it's one thing to be back there. It's another thing to understand where you are. And
how you got there. And
yeah.
That's why I go through the stages, my charts of stages of apprehension. And I mm-hmm. say, okay, you're looking at it. This is only linear. So it's a distortion of it. But I got to use linearity with you because you don't know the non-linearity yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's what I've been explaining. You know, in McLuhan, Hot and Cool, I think, Pro and Con, one of the essays is, which way did the second coming went? I always liked that title. And I have the second coming in an earlier version of my chart, a smaller one. And I say in the 70s, we arrived at the second coming collectively. And I was using the Evergreens definition. I asked them, what do you say the second coming is? And they didn't give a Christian response. They said, it's a situation of perpetual change. So I knew we were into perpetual change by the 70s, and it's just been intensified and took on a life of its own, and humans are surplus flesh. They're sitting on the sidelines, watching the perfect environment of endless change.
Yeah. So I just want to add a footnote to what you were saying earlier. I forget where, but McLuhan says... Einstein said that E equals mc squared. And then he says, but what happened to the first C?
Is that right? Where does he say that?
I don't know. I'll find it for you.
That's
if you
pretty
want.
Good.
That's good, yeah.
And what, C is the speed of light?
Yes.
Yeah, so what happened to the first one? Well, another little childish question from McLuhan. As I've been accused by certain McLuhanites, Bob's just a shit disturber. That's what McLuhan was, a fucking shit disturber with his questions. And he used to brag that he had all the questions. And they were silly questions. Where's the first C? Come on. And I end with that mocking tone. We've got a C. We've talked about pretty well close to 2 hours. So when I upload the recording, we'll see if it says an hour and 40 minutes or something considerably less than 2 hours, then we'll know that some of it didn't get recorded, and it may have even shut off 20 minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. So I'll just close by saying I sent you the last paragraph of Footsteps.
Okay, great. All right, yeah, I see that there. Fantastic. Okay, so let's see what damage we've done, and... I would say that what we said the last 20 minutes, it's a tragedy it didn't get recorded because we said a lot of good stuff there in our conclusion.
You may get surprised.
Yes, let's hope it worked. I have to figure out. I'm actually going to have to go back and re-listen to parts of it, which I never do, and see what's it sound like when I'm talking and you can't hear me. And
right.
You're talking, I can't hear. What happened there? Okay, so we'll see. Very good. We got through a quote. We did my book for the whole show. We did a quote.
That's right.
All right. Do you think we've exhausted? We can move on next week?
Yes.
Next time?
Well, what I would like to do, I mean, I don't know if you want to do it, but I think you went into a rant in the book.
You want to do that? Okay. We got to do that.
Yeah, there's three pages of you talking, and but I think you make some good points there.
Okay, good. All right.
Yeah.
Great
Goodbye.
Talking to you, Cameron. We'll talk soon.
Same here.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.